This is Joe Richmond interviewing Ace McCarron. If we could start with just telling me when you first became involved with No Fit State and what brought you to that place.
I don't remember why I was there. I just happened to be lighting the show for them and somebody obviously asked me, but the subsequent trauma has erased the memory of the actual contract, if there ever was one. But I was asked to help with a giant community show, which we did in an old Boots warehouse and became a show called Prophecy, directed by Orit Azaz, which was a giant project which they put together from as many community groups as they could muster who wanted to help and work on the show. It was huge. It was barely manageable, but of course, a huge triumph and success.
Okay.
This would have been in the early 90s. And I think I was living in Bristol at that point, but I was doing a lot of work in Cardiff, so they'd obviously got my name from somewhere. I'd vaguely heard of the company before.
I was about to say, what did you know of No Fit State before then?
Yes, you don't forget a name like the No Fit State Circus. And I knew they were based in Cardiff, but I didn't quite realise how crazy they were. I normally work as a lighting designer, and they were looking for a lighting designer to work on this show. It was happening in a non-theatre space, so therefore the lights had to be installed, and the way that the lights got suspended and hired and connected was all part of the design. So they knew that I was a kind of hands-on lighting designer who could help out with that and make good suggestions. And of course they had certain resources of the things you need to do that. They had a certain amount of lights themselves, but we hired a lot of the rig, and we hired the truss to suspend the lights from the roof and to turn this space into something which was very much, for a short time, a licensed theatre. And we had to get this safety licence from the local council, which was kind of the single thing that had to happen in this show. We couldn't let the audience in unless we had a certificate saying that the means of escape, the emergency facilities, the limit of the capacity of the crowd, and the limit of the number of people in the building had to be fulfilled. And someone had to sign this from the council. And the health and safety executive was around in those days, so we had to do it all rather properly.
Mm. Was that a hard thing to achieve?
It's not a hard thing to achieve when you're just focused on that one thing, but when you've got a giant complicated show running as well, it's one thing that is really burning at the back of your mind that absolutely has to happen, otherwise everything else is futile. And there was a bit of a celebration when the council said yes, and we did have a bit of paper saying that we could open as a theatre. And then Tim Hudson, our production manager, was particularly keen to celebrate this and crowed about it for a very, very long time. Whereas we were all too busy to celebrate. We had many too many things to do to get this show on. So, yes, it was a crazy time.
Yeah. So was it different to anything you'd worked on up until then?
Not really. I'd done stuff at the Edinburgh Festival, and I'd done a fair amount of site-specific work there. Probably nothing as big. I may have never worked on as big a show as Prophecy and the sequel to that, which is called Now Dot Here. In terms of the numbers of people involved, they were huge, because each of the community groups had, on average, 12 to 15 members, some more, some less. And there were maybe, I don't know, 15, 16 of these groups. So there was a huge number of people involved. There were the core performers from the company as well, the acrobats and the circus performers. There were musicians, there were video people, there were a huge amount of ancillary people involved in this as well. A lot of volunteers, a lot of students came to be involved. Stage management students, I remember, from Welsh College. And also graphic design and web students would come along to help with the projections in the show. Technically, it was very, very ambitious. But I think the most ambitious part of it was just the direction of the show. The assembly of the whole show with lots of people with different talents and different skills to form it into something which was a continuum as a show. And this was done kind of very late in the rehearsal process, where Orrit would kind of walk out with a powerful microphone and address 250 people, and you know, we'd all be keen to hear what she was going to say, because she couldn't plan it, and nobody could plan something as big and as complicated as that. So when she spoke, everybody in the room had to listen, and I, of course, I had to organise lights for things that she was inventing out of thin air, which was, in one way, very exciting. and I had to organise lights for things that were happening right in front of me. And the preparations I'd made for that were pretty good, but sometimes you had to work very, very fast and very, very quickly. I would normally work with the director very, very closely, in order that when they're at their busiest point, they can turn to me and flex an eyebrow, and I know exactly what they mean.
Okay.
This was not the case. Or it would turn around and say, "Ace, can we have some lights over there, please?" And I'd go, give me a minute. My ideal is to not hold up that process, is to service things very, very quickly for a director. And it went not badly. Okay. When it came to the big rehearsals in the evening, there's certain things that we kind of knew were going to happen kind of over there, and we'd make as many provisions for that as we could. But when we got to the big rehearsals, suddenly it was all happening, and you know, this genius of a director was having ideas that were really good ideas, and you thought, that's going to be good. How do we do that? Let's try this. And so there's a great deal of experimentation in very high-pressured situations going on. And when you got through an evening like that, you just felt brilliant. You just said, "Oh, wow, I can't believe what we did tonight." And, of course, that was the experience across the boards. Everybody kind of felt that. Everybody felt they were part of something giant. And, you know, I think everybody scurried home. So I said, "You've got to come and see this show, because you would not believe what's going on there." Mm-hmm. The circus aspects of it were striking and wonderful, but actually there was communities that you never came across before, and a lot of ethnic communities had come along with dancers or with music, and you thought, "Oh, normally I wouldn't get a chance to see people like this, but really they're really good. They're having a great time, and they're doing wonderful work out there." So you felt that you were part of a giant community, which was great buzz, I have to say.
Can you have a go at describing what the show was like?
Prophecy was took to do with people who could see in the future and claimed to be able to see the future and to describe the future, and a lot of cranks were portrayed on stage as well. And it kind of bombarded you with ideas of how you form your image of the future. And what that future can be like, and how wonderful it can be, and how magical it can be, and kind of examined how sensible it is to do that, and the demons that lie in wait for you when you subscribe to a vision of the future. At the very end of the show, they had just again bought another very, very expensive video projector, costing a couple of thousand. And Tom Rack was wandering with it under his arm through the audience, projecting at various parts of the scenery. And there was a succession of monster faces came up. It was wonderful, but, you know, if someone said to me, "We want to buy an expensive piece of equipment, we want to give it to Tom Rack, and he wants to carry it through the audience with these cables dangling behind him," I would have said, "Is this the wisest thing to do?" I thought this was pretty crazy, but, of course, it was wonderful to see. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really good. It was a marriage of quite a lot of skills, the people who'd done the generation of the projection content, and the people who had to try and find a cable that would get through the audience without killing anyone or tripping over it, to do it in the dark and to organise the scheduling of it, the queuing of it. You know, it all happened in minutes. But we thought, this is not a wise thing to do, but it was wonderful. It was a great thing to see, and one of the strongest moments in the show, I felt.
Okay. Do you have any stories from that time that you'd like to share with us?
I think we kind of lived there inside this warehouse. Normally they live in tents. I don't do tents. They kind of look at me like, no, he's a kind of guest house kind of a guy. But we all kind of inhabited this warehouse for the duration of the 2 or 3 weeks it took us to do the installation and do all the rehearsals. So it had toilets, which, you know, is always a bonus for me. I always think that the toilets are a good thing, and I never take them for granted. You know, sometimes in John Street the toilets have been in the past a little uninhabitable, but there were things that you'd need there. You know, I found out the design department actually did live there. They actually had hammocks in the control area where they were actually staying overnight. And I had to come in the morning thinking I was there in advance of everybody else, and found that when I made a noise, I woke them up. So I thought, okay, maybe this is, I'm not making myself the most popular person here. But also we had, they had access to some moving lights that I'd only barely used at that point, and a kind of controller which is more associated with rock and roll lights, which was pushing it for me. I really didn't know, wasn't as conversant with that kind of equipment as I would have preferred to have been. And sometimes they didn't work, and sometimes they did. But that was the part of the lighting that you could have complete control over during a rehearsal. You could say, they've got to be blue, they've got to be over there, let's do it. And so I was struggling to do this and beginning to wish I'd done my homework a bit better for all of that. And also nobody kind of saw the whole show because of the shape of the space. There were bits happening where nobody could quite see them all. So there was always a great impetus to chat to people, sort of say, what exactly goes on over there? And they go, oh, it's marvellous, you want to see that bit. And we formed a giant control scaffolding structure that looked down on the whole show. And part of the show was people somersaulting onto crash mats, big thick crash mats, what they're called. And two of these structures had to be joined together and they came apart. And so Rian had to rush on and hold these two things together. And then at the end of the show, a student came up, a very talented stage management student, and very diplomatically sort of explained to me that one of the acrobats had fallen onto Rian and she couldn't walk. And I thought if anyone had to explain that to me to make sure I wasn't going to punch anybody, it would have to be Vicky. Vicky Gibson was extremely gifted at this sort of thing. And just suddenly there were people there who would give anything to this show and worked very hard and were very polite about it all. Oh, here we are.
Just pause it then. Okay. Any other memories from
that? We set up a production office in this warehouse, and the whole thing was organised from this one desk in this old office, and Tim, our production manager, who was, you know, famously blunt, direct, and uncompromising, had bought a new laptop. I didn't possess a computer at this point, and the whole thing was kind of organised around this Mac laptop that we were all struggling to use and figure out how it worked. And he was very impressed with this and very proud of this, and knew that he, you know, I'll just show you how to use this. And then he'd hit buttons and go, oh no, it's not doing it. Oh no, it's not doing it. What's up with this machine, you know? So we were always very amused about this, and he made great claims for this laptop and how it was new and how they were going to upgrade the operating system very shortly, and in the middle of the process we did upgrade the operating system on this laptop and lost all of our files, all the administration, all of the invoices, all of the schedules, all of the lists. This was all gone, and so I was kind of thrown into the deep end of trying to work with a computer system that then really seriously malfunctioned. But eventually, when they were playing with it, they managed to find out that there was a recorder on this. There's a microphone in the laptop, which is commonplace now, but it was actually rather exciting then. And they were trying this out, and they recorded me speaking on the phone to one of the suppliers. And they kept on playing this back, me speaking on the phone to one of the suppliers. And, they were laughing about it. They think this is quite a great thing, that they'd actually spied on Ace making a deal over the telephone. And so much so that I wanted revenge quite badly for this. So I noticed that you can record sounds on the computer, but but then you could assign those sounds to the different functions on the machine. It wasn't just a sound recorder. You could use it as a you could put any of the sound files to anywhere in the computer and use them under certain circumstances. So the error message when you did something wrong was this kind of noise. And I changed this to me shouting, "Concentrate!" And I thought this would be a great prank. I never heard anything more about this. This was just something I did in a spare 15 seconds that I had there. Then I rushed on and did the show. 10 years later, I heard the stories that he'd be using his laptop. This machine would shout, "Concentrate!" And he would thump the desk and go, "Bastard, Ace McCarron, why has he done this? I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill this guy." But by the time he'd sorted it out, he'd calmed down again, and we'd have to just get on and do things as well, like this. And so 10 years later, I found out the results of this prank, and everybody was telling me, "Yes, you made him furious by doing that." And I thought, "Oh, good." Tim is a brilliant guy, and he's just the right man in certain situations when things are about to go out of control. And for the second show, Now Dot Here, I think my greatest contribution to the show was not anything to do with the lighting, but with the communications ring that we have to do cues between the various sound, recorded sound, lighting, video, are all communicating by headsets. And Rhiann was the stage manager calling those cues during the show. And I designed, there were two circuits on these headsets, so you could choose to speak to two sets, or one person could choose to speak to two sets of people. So we made sure that Tim could only speak to Rhiann, because things would happen like, "Will you tell us fucking video people together?" And this and that. And Rhiann, I'd be listening to both of these, and then I'd hear Rhiann sort of saying, "Tim suggesting that if you stood by for that queue just a little earlier, you might get it on time." There was a great deal of diplomacy going on between a furious production manager who was spitting feathers at the front edge of the seating bank. And, you know, Rhiann was keeping the rest of the crew calm and, if possible, focused. And the video cues were always famously late. And then Rhiann would come on camera and say, "Can you stand by for video cues?" And of course, you always got to acknowledge your standby. Say, "Yes, yes, thank you, I'm standing by." You'd get nothing from the video people. And she just says, she turned around, "Can you stand by the video?" "Smile and nod," she said famously once. And they kind of got the message then that they had to tell her that they were ready and that they could go. But, you know, the pressure of managing a show of that size when it's being invented out of thin air with not much in the way of a script in front of you was huge. But I'm sure that everybody would tell a similar story of the size of the task that they were undertaking in doing that.
Must have been an incredible experience for the, well, not just for yourselves, but for the students that were involved and members of all these different communities.
Yes, that's right. Because sometimes you bump into people and say, "Oh, you were in that show," and they go, "Oh, yeah, wasn't that wonderful?" For the great bonding experience for Now Dot Here was the fact that we got a kind of free upgrade on a projector that we hired. And instead of one that's the size of a medium-sized suitcase, we got one that's the size of, you know, a small car. And we put a ladder up onto the grid and thought, we can't lift this thing up here. And Tom Rack said, "Oh, hang on, I think there's something around the corner that can help us." And drove out in a truck-sized scissor lift. You know, you could get maybe 30 people on top of this thing. Which we might not have been allowed to use, but we were using it anyway because it was the only way we were going to rig this projector. So we drove this thing into the centre of the space and pressed the button, and the scissor lift went straight up to the ceiling, and we rigged this projector, which was kind of movie-sized. You know, the screen was maybe about 25 metres wide. It was a huge screen, and we used that as part of the show. There were certain scenes that took place on the video. And again, you couldn't experience the whole show unless you were free to walk around like the audience were. So again, none of us had seen the show by the time it opened, but of course they had a video camera, a guy with a very expensive video camera running around filming everything, and used to leap across this space to get things on video. And of course at the end of the show he had a single tape with the whole show on it, and this screen happened to be above the bar for the interval, so at the end of the show everybody would walk straight to the bar and have a drink, but then they'd just put on a projection of the whole show. So we'd sit and we'd watch the whole show that night. And of course, people say, "Oh yeah, I can't believe we did that bit. Is that what you do? This is wonderful, right? This bit went well. Watch this. Yes, there we go." It was a great kind of spectator sport to watch the show that you'd just done.
Yeah.
And I think
over the three or four performances, we did that every night. We'd come in and we'd watch the show. We'd do the show, then we'd watch it again. So, by the time you'd got to the end of that, it was, about midnight, it's time to go home. But we'd done a great show. We'd had a drink and we'd had a bit of a laugh at watching the whole thing being projected. Those tapes must still exist somewhere. Somebody must have them. And, to see them again would be wonderful because so many people were involved. Some people who are sadly no longer with us as well, which would be a great thing to see.